I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A strange thing happened 2 years ago at the start of the pandemic when many people stopped going to the office. While there was much less traffic on the road, there were more fatal crashes. Was it related to the stresses and frustrations of the pandemic? Were the safe drivers staying home? Were the open roads an invitation to speed, to drive recklessly? Road fatalities in the U.S. have been on the rise in recent years. And if you drive, cycle, or are a pedestrian, then you can attest to all the bad driving. Motorists cruising through red lights and stop signs, weaving in and out of rush hour traffic, talking on their phones, oblivious to their surroundings. Well, today on Radio Times, what to do about bad drivers, and how can we make our roads and vehicles safer for everyone, including drivers, passengers, pedestrians, and cyclists. We have two guests who have joined us. Nicole Morris is director of the Human First Laboratory and a research scholar at the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. Nicole Morris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Jake Nelson. He's Director of Traffic Safety Advocacy and Research for AAA. And Jake Nelson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
And to our listeners, I'm doing this at the top of the show only because we had so many comments on our Facebook page yesterday. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Jake, let me begin with you. Is it my imagination, or are we seeing more aggressive, reckless drivers on the road?
It's not your imagination. This is real life, true story, an unfortunate one at that.
Do you think it's pandemic related? Do we know what's, in a sense, driving this?
Well, we know some of those answers, but we can't explain all of it away. We at AAA did a study not too long ago, a survey of motorists throughout the United States to try to dig into this a little bit. And what we found was that in effect, about 60% of drivers in the U.S. told us that they drove less because of the pandemic. And when we looked at who those drivers were, they were among the safest drivers on the road. Oh. And the motorists who said that they were driving more during the pandemic turned out to be among the riskiest on the road, in effect, changing the risk profile of motorists on the road, not just for themselves, but for all of us who share the roadways.
And just a quick follow-up before, Nicole, I get you in on the conversation. And riskier drivers, who are they?
So the motorists who told us they were driving more during the pandemic were tended to be younger and tended to be male. But even when controlling for age and gender, by the way, younger males tend to be the riskiest people on the road statistically at all times, not just during the pandemic. But when we even control for those factors, this same group of drivers told us that they were more likely to engage in all kinds of risk-taking behavior behind the wheel, including texting and reading emails while driving, aggressive driving behavior, speeding, and impaired driving.
Well, Nicole, what's your analysis? How do we explain what's going on the roadways?
Right. There's a number of issues that have been growing over time. So we see that speeding has been growing among their fleet, where people are becoming more and more engaged in speeding and super speeding. And that really has been kicked off during the pandemic, where we're seeing just an inordinate amount of drivers who are super speeding. And what I mean by that is traveling, say, over 100 miles an hour.
Whoa.
On our highways. And another thing that's really added to this is, what's the penalty and sort of the fear of repercussions if you do speed? And because of a number of issues, including the murder of George Floyd, we have many police agencies that are starting to draw back and doing less traffic enforcement on our roadways. And so drivers are starting to notice that there's less risk of the most type of prevalent penalty that they foresee, which is ticket. But they're really missing that more important component, that they're really posing a danger to their community and to themselves through that speeding. So that's really one of the many things that are going along with, you know, shifting in our fleet with more and more large trucks and SUVs that are really a risk to everyone on the roadway.
Sure. I mean, the bigger the vehicle, the bigger the risk. Nicole, I don't want to blame everything on the pandemic, but I'm wondering whether, you know, just literally the stresses of the pandemic, whether that has affected how people drive.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. When you think about the types of decisions that we make on the roadway, and you really do need to suppress a lot of impulses when you're driving. So, you know, you may be late, you may be feeling upset about something going on in your personal life or your work life, and it's easy to kind of creep up over the speed limit or be aggressive to another driver, and you really have to suppress those tendencies to be a really a safe driver. But when you have a lot of additional stress that you're experiencing, and certainly we have all been inundated with a tremendous amount of stress, it really overloads us and makes it harder and harder for people to have that cool head when they're driving and make smart and safe decisions.
Well, Jake, picking up on that, I was thinking about, we've all seen, you know, videos of people misbehaving on airplanes or in stores. Do you think some of this, you know, irresponsible, reckless driving is just related to that similar kind of behavior?
Yeah, I mean, I think the stress and anxiety and depression that people have felt during the pandemic, for all the obvious reasons, the economic stress of it all, job loss, just fears tied to your own health and safety and that of your friends and family, I think it all just has added up and has taken its toll on all of us. And it's affected some of us in ways different from others, including how we might behave behind the wheel of the car.
Elijah put a comment on our Facebook page, and he says, seems like police in his town aren't doing much to target dangerous drivers. Jake, is that a problem? And Nicole talked about the fact that there might be less ticketing on the road, for instance.
Yeah. Well, I do think that what Nicole shared is accurate to some extent. I think it explains part of the problem that we're seeing. And certainly during the early stages of the pandemic, when we were in lockdowns in many states, the associations representing police agencies throughout North America and around the world were issuing recommendations to law enforcement organizations to not make traffic stops unless they were, you know, egregious reasons warranting the stop. And I agree with Nicole that with George Floyd and the many other examples in that same file occurred in our country, it has affected the way that police officers do their jobs every day. And I think that they do, you know, have some pause when making a decision about making a traffic stop, even if their motivation is sincere and tied to a moving violation. So, I think all these factors play a role in some way. And I think the big question is to what magnitude?
Well, and picking up on that, I'm thinking, you know, if you see a police officer who has pulled over a car and you're driving, you tend to slow down. Or if you see a police car on the road, you tend to slow down. Correct, Jake?
Yeah, that is true. But then, of course, once you feel like you're out of sight,
right,
you speed up. And I think we're all, you know, guilty about that at one point or another. One other factor that we've not talked about that our research has uncovered is that, there are theories around how we perceive risk and, you know, the tasks that we can engage in certain environments. And so during normal driving conditions, when the roads are congested in a way that feels normal to us, like pre-pandemic levels of motorists on the road, the kinds of things that we might, the kinds of risks that we might take will be different than when it's an open road, empty. And this is just normal psychology, normal human behavior, is when you have an open road in front of you, you might take risks that you otherwise wouldn't because you feel like they're more manageable given the environment that you're in. And during the pandemic, when, you know, there was a 43% drop in the number of miles that people were traveling in our country, I think that some of that was at play. And I think people were taking risks that they may not normally take for that reason.
Nicole, you talked about super speeders, and I have to confess, a couple of years ago, on vacation in Germany, driving on the Autobahn, and, you know, my husband and I, we were driving 100 miles an hour, not in the passing lane, along with everybody else. No one was weaving in and out of traffic. And then, of course, there were the fancy cars that were in the passing lane that were probably going 120 miles an hour. But what struck me was sort of how well-behaved people were, even though we were going at these what felt like a reckless speed.
Sure. So one of the things that we need to think about speeding is this important component of what we call speed differentials. So if everyone is traveling kind of together, then you tend to mitigate some of those risks of how fast you're going because you don't have some people that are following the speed limit at 55 miles an hour and other people that are going 85 miles an hour. Those types of differentials are quite dangerous. So the challenge is that the physics are against us at the end of the day. So even if everyone seems to be being very well behaved, it doesn't take a whole lot for destruction to break down on the Autobahn. And so our bodies just cannot sustain crashes at those speeds. And this problem is not just on our highways. So if you start to think about inside of our city limits where we have speed limits of 30 miles an hour, and someone may think, well, it's fine if I travel at say 40 or 45 miles an hour, that's not that much above the speed limit, but it really matters for that pedestrian who is going to have a 73% likelihood of a fatality or severe injury at 40 miles an hour, but only a 13% likelihood of fatality or injury at 20 miles an hour. So those small differences in speed really matter to our most vulnerable road users.
And I'm thinking about fatalities. Is it, Nicole, more dangerous on highways or in the sort of middle, I don't know what to call these roads, you know, the roads that are not highways but are busy? I mean, where do most fatalities take place?
Well, often we see fatalities taking place in rural parts of each of our, you know, respective states, and that's for a number of reasons. So you're going to tend to be at higher speeds out on rural roadways, so exceeding 55 miles an hour and the other issue is really emergency response. So when you're out in a rural area and you're involved in a crash, it takes time for emergency services to reach you, and you may not have a level one trauma center that's nearby. The other issue is some of those infrastructure that we have out on our rural highways, our county roads. You're going to have two-lane roadways with no types of dividers, and so we have a lot of risk of head-on injuries. Or run off the road injuries where you're going to hit a fixed object, so a tree, a culvert. Those types of forces and impacts, again, are very hard to survive. So all of those things combined are often why we see our greatest fatalities in rural parts of our states.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. This is Nicole Morris. She's director of the Human First Laboratory, also a research scholar at the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. Jake Nelson is with us as well, director of traffic safety advocacy and research for AAA, and we are talking about how people behave and misbehave on the road. We'll be talking about how to make smarter, safer, better roads and cars. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guests about reckless drivers and driving, how to bring some more law and order to the roadways, how to design safer cars and highways. Andrea, who couldn't stay on the line, Jake said, are cars, faster cars, to blame? Are we building cars that are actually more dangerous, let's say, for pedestrians or cyclists or maybe even for motorists?
No, that's a good question. In fact, I just had a conversation on this very topic relative to speed in particular with, you know, the nation's experts in the context of self-driving cars last week. And one of the questions that were posed during that forum was, you know, if we're talking about a world where cars may eventually drive themselves entirely, why are we designing vehicles that can travel over the maximum posted speed limit in our country? And there was an interesting lesson in history that was shared with us during that forum, that it's, you know, consumers, the public, all of us, were simply unwilling to accept that, unwilling to accept the inability to travel at high speeds if we wanted to, should we be on an open road. That sort of like scenario that I described before, where if you're on an open road and, you know, the risk that you perceive in going over the speed limit in that section of roadway because you don't think you'll get caught and there are no other cars around, so what's the harm and what's the risk to me? So interesting lesson in history there. But I will say that a lot of automakers are building technologies into cars that are designed to identify and to detect pedestrians and cyclists out on the road to help drive down fatalities among those vulnerable road users. But unfortunately, you know, while most of the pedestrians and cyclists who are killed in traffic crashes are killed at night, these technologies, at least today, don't work in those kinds of conditions where most of those fatalities occur. So there are some opportunity there, I think, for industry to improve the design of the systems that they're building into cars to protect the most vulnerable.
Nicole, I was reading about some research that looked at, I think it was SUVs, but nonetheless, intersections where you've got cars, you know, say making a turn, and you've also got pedestrians that want to cross an intersection. And that can be, you know, a very dangerous place for a pedestrian. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So unfortunately, where we see many fatal crashes involving pedestrians in crosswalks are at signalized intersections, so where the pedestrian has the walk signal, but it's that right or left turning vehicle that is the problem. So the signal does a good job to reduce these conflicts, but for turning vehicles, they have a green or green ball, and so they may not be thinking about when I make a turn through that intersection, I still need to yield to a pedestrian. And so sometimes they're taking a gap in traffic. They want to take a small gap, and they turn very quickly. And ultimately, the speed at which they strike that pedestrian in the crosswalk can be fatal. So it's a real problem that we have at our signalized intersections, but also at unsignalized intersections, both marked and unmarked. We have drivers that are simply not abiding by their state's crosswalk law, which is to yield or stop to pedestrians at those crosswalks. And we see really low rates of drivers yielding or stopping at crosswalks in my research studies.
Well, and in my observation, I'm sure a lot of other people's observations, Nicole, is that people run red lights on a routine basis. They roll through stop signs on a routine basis. It's as if it doesn't mean anything. It's very frustrating. It's one of my pet peeves, to be honest with you. Go ahead, Nicole.
Yeah, so, you know, when we think about some of the psychology behind some of these types of risk-taking behaviors, we'll look to a theory known as attribution theory, where drivers tend to think about their own behaviors as dispositional. So situational. So they're in a hurry, they're late for work, or, you know, this jackal over here has made me do this thing. And none of this is really about my own personality or tendencies. The environment around me sort of forced me to behave in a way that isn't right, but it's not really my fault. But we look to other drivers and we think of their behavior as dispositional, like they're speeding because they're a bad person, or they don't care about safety, or they cut me off because they're a jerk. And so this kind of drives some of the way that we think about driving, right? When I do something bad, it's because the forces around me kind of forced me to do it. When other people do things bad, it's because they're a bad person. And it really doesn't help us all collectively come to a solution on how do we all behave better on the roadway? How do we all be really safe stewards of our community when we're traveling in these really dangerous machines?
Well, Jake, and I wonder whether these dangerous machines, these vehicles, sort of give us that sense of invulnerability, that what we do is not going to hurt us, but it's not going to affect other people. That somehow we're in this several ton vehicle, but feel as if we're oblivious to the world, or can be oblivious to the world.
Yeah. So there are a couple couple of factors at play here. One is related to the design of vehicles and the technologies built into them, and another is, you know, human psychology, similar to the kinds of things Nicole is sharing with us. You know, motorists, humans in general, we tend to overestimate our skills and abilities on all kinds of things, including driving. So we all think we're better than average. So if we're making a decision to, you know, blow a stop sign through an intersection that we think is vacant or assume is vacant, you know, we're able to manage that. If we choose to text while driving, well, I can manage this multitasking. It's the guy over there that I don't trust to do it. And so that's super common in general, and I think it was common during the pandemic as well. So I think that that's at play. And then the way vehicles are designed, it's true that vehicles are more crash-worthy now than they have ever been, which is good.
Yeah. We're
also seeing a lot of introduction of new technologies designed to, you know, warn us of impending crashes or hazards in our driving environment, and in some cases even take over to eliminate those crashes, like automatic emergency braking, for example. One of the dangers with these technologies is that people tend to overestimate what they can do for them and when they'll work and when they won't. And so the auto industry has not done a very good job at, you know, how they label, name, or describe these technologies, which can lead to consumers overestimating what these technologies do for us. But the industry also has done a poor job at educating consumers, all of us, about the environments and the use cases when these technologies won't work or when they weren't designed to work. And so, for example, a lot of these advanced driver assistance technologies rely on radar, LiDAR, and cameras.
Yeah.
And these are technologies that simply don't work in heavy snow, fog, or heavy rain. And if you don't know that as a driver, you may rely on these technologies to protect you in scenarios that the technologies weren't designed to function.
Nicole, some unintended consequences, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. Jake is exactly right of really what has happened with the marketing and the way that some of this tech is being introduced to the public. And I think it's really important that we start to differentiate some of the features that I call safety features versus those that are really convenience features. So things like adaptive cruise control or lane keep assist, those may have some moderate safety impacts, but really are designed to make driving more comfortable. And it's really those momentary types of tech assistance, like the automated emergency braking, where you get momentary support. That's really safety systems. And we really need to be not conflating the two. But it's true, as people start to think that if their car has a feature called, say, autopilot, they may really overestimate how much that car is driving itself and really misinterpret that the tech is assisting them and not the other way around. So it's really a problem with the types of risk-taking that we're starting to see with drivers, you know, napping or reading or watching movies, when really they're supposed to be the driver and the tech is supporting them.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Nicole Morris, and she's director of the Human First Laboratory. Jake Nelson is with us, director of traffic safety advocacy and research for AAA. We are talking about cars and motorists and how to have some more safety on the road, how to think about how to drive this vehicle in a way that's protective of everybody. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499. In fact, we've got Brad, and Brad is joining us from Haddonfield, New Jersey. And Brad, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
One of the things I think you're really missing in your conversation is the distracted driving and the number of people that are talking and texting. You go on the Jersey Turnpike and the traffic will be going 80 miles an hour, yep, and more than half the people are talking and texting at 85 miles an hour. That's the bigger threat, because they're not paying attention. And you see it everywhere, side roads, main roads, traffic, elderly people, people with the physical disability tags in their car, everybody is talking on the phone. The aggressive driving is one factor. This is the other end of the curve.
Absolutely. No question about it, Brad. I'm glad you raised it. It was certainly on my list of things to talk about. And Jake, one of the things that I read is that, you know, distracted driving is not unlike driving drunk in terms of people's inability to pay attention.
It's true. There's actually a phenomenon called inattention blindness, where if your mind, if you think of your brain as like a computer, and if you're trying to do more than one thing at a time, it's like having too many apps open on your phone or too many programs running on your computer. It all eats up some of the bandwidth, and then your computer runs more slowly. Well, the same is true for your brain. And inattention blindness is when you're engaging or task switching too often, and you're eating up the bandwidth in your brain, and your brain is unable to process the visual information you're taking in through your eyes from the driving environment, and you don't actually see it. And so there are case studies of drivers who are on camera blowing through a red light and striking a motorist passing through that intersection, T-boning them. And that motorist swore that the light was green for them, but they were distracted at the time. And there's video proof that it was completely red the entire time they approached it, hit the car, and continued on through the intersection. They legitimately didn't even see the red light because their brain was focused on something different. So if your mental focus is elsewhere, you're not processing the information you're bringing in visually.
Even if you're looking out your windshield, you're not seeing that red light.
That's right. In some cases, if your mental focus is not on the primary task of driving, you may not even be processing in your brain the visual information you're taking in through your windshield, like a red light, a pedestrian walking across the street, or a turning car.
Nicole, let me get another caller on. This is related. This is Jennifer calling us into Radio Times. Jennifer from Philadelphia. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I have a theory that millennials grew up playing video games, a lot of which involved car races and crashes. And I think that they were just seeing these horrible, outcomes and crashes on the screen with, no real consequences. It was all just virtual reality. So perhaps they also feel a sense of immortality as they race around dangerously.
I hear you. Jennifer, that's really an interesting thought. Nicole, do you want to take that?
Yeah, so that's a great point of, the different age groups that we have on the roadway, and there's certainly a correlation of our young people who just tend to be more engaged in sensation seeking. They're really lacking that frontal lobe development that we don't get until really later adulthood. So young people are just really have that feeling of invincibility, regardless of what types of engagement that they have in video gaming, and that's kind of an issue that we're always working against, and particularly with young males, that they're really going to be higher in sensation seeking. The role that video games have, I can't really speak to that. There's a whole sort of field of that. I do know that some psychology says that when people are engaged in those types of video games, they really do process it as play. When we watch other people play video games, we don't see it as play in the same way. So there is a lot to dig into there.
Let me read an email from Marisol, who says, can elderly drivers be required to take driver's tests when they turn a certain age to make sure they still have the skills to drive safely? Jake, that does exist, doesn't it?
Yeah, so every state has laws that vary from one state to the next that, indicate when a driver has to retest for their driver's license. And it can range between, 5, 2, 5, or even 8 years to retest for your driver's license, depending on what age you are. One of the risks there, especially for, the aging population, is that our likelihood of being at fault in crashes tends to go up as we reach, ages 70, 75 and older. But also our ability to survive the injuries we would sustain in crashes goes way down. And one of the challenges, I think, with sort of laws that require retesting for the driver's license is the research to date has really found no safety-related benefit of requiring all drivers who reach a certain age, let's say 70, 75 years old, to come and retest in person for their license. Huh. In fact, there's been identified harm in those kinds of policies because a lot of older drivers will make, you know, in some cases, the incorrect assumption that they won't pass that driver's test and they'll give up their personal mobility, which can have all kinds of other negative implications for, you know, how you view the world, your happiness, and how long you might live. So it's important to retest in person. There are a lot of benefits to that, but unfortunately, there's really no science to support at what age that should happen. It should just be at regular intervals.
Well, that's fascinating. Nicole, here's Howard with his pet peeve. He says turn signals that are tiny and hard to see and turn signals that seem to be rarely used. I can attest to that as well. I mean, is this about driver's ed? Do we need to sort of get a refresher course?
Right. I think it is really a challenge, and like Jake said, we have a hard time drawing a straight line between driver's ed and these types of testing and training, in part because there is so much variability in the standards and the experiences that people get in some of these types of training. And much of the types of testing that we have, so not the behind-the-wheel testing, but the type of testing, kind of pen and paper, is almost more like a trivia test than really true knowledge. Do you remember exactly how many feet you need to park from the fire hydrant? That's not necessarily the type of knowledge that I'd really like to know that drivers have to make sure that they're safe on our roadways. But unfortunately, that's much of what our driver's ed types of testing is. Do you hold the type of trivia that we have in the manual? Not necessarily, are you a safe driver and do you know how to behave responsibly on the roadway? Those are really two very different things. And I think we have a long way to go until we figure out the right solution here.
And we're almost having a break here. I mean, it'd be hard to test, you know, the sort of real world experience of a driver.
Right, exactly.
What they actually do under real circumstances. Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the fact that we're all observing more reckless drivers, speeding, running red lights, stop signs, weaving in and out of traffic. We're talking about how to address that problem, also how to design safer cars and highways. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about aggressive drivers, what we can do to bring, frankly, some more law and order to our roadways. Our guests are Jake Nelson, Director of Traffic Safety Advocacy and Research for AAA, and Nicole Morris, Director of the Human First Laboratory. She's a research scholar at the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. Actually, our engineer, Charlie, Jake, had a question about whether we say car crash or car accident. Do those words matter?
I think they do, because I think that each brings its own connotation, right? So if we talk about, you know, a motor vehicle accident or a car accident, it implies that it can't be prevented. And we know that that's just simply not the case at all. I believe truly all car crashes are preventable. And there are a lot of factors that go into that, but, you know, we could be designing the driving environment that we all operate in with redundancies or layers of protection that reduce to zero or eliminate the likelihood that we'll be severely injured in a crash if one occurs, and will obviously, if done well, reduce the likelihood that the crash will occur in the first place.
That's Vision Zero, right? That's this idea of essentially eliminating car crashes.
It's in part, yeah. Vision Zero is more the goal of moving the nation towards zero highway fatalities, but I think that the process that we use to get there is a process called the safe systems approach, and this is how sort of other developed nations around the world have, you know, reduced the number of motor vehicle deaths in their countries over the course of, you know, a decade or two by as much as 80%.
Here's a comment, Nicole, from Lorraine, who says, please address pedestrians who cross against the light, step out mid-block, or text while crossing. Thank you. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really important that pedestrians behave in a way that's predictable to other drivers. And so as we're attempting to cross the road, it is really important to abide by traffic signals and to signal our intention to cross. Wait until drivers are actually yielding or coming to a stop before we step out into the roadway. I always tell pedestrians, you can't trust that drivers are going to stop for you just because you think you've made eye contact with them. I have lots of times when I'm out doing my research and lock eyes with drivers and they go on past me as I'm standing right there in the crosswalk. So it's really important to be really defensive as you're out there as a pedestrian. And so all of these riskier walking behaviors, like what our caller has listed, is really a problem. And we do need to make sure that everyone is being safe on our roadways, including pedestrians. But really, there are a lot of things going on here with pedestrian behavior and infrastructure. So, for example, mid-block crossing, particularly at night, is a really big problem. But at the end of the day, if you have to walk a half mile to get to the next marked signalized crosswalk, that's a real problem for pedestrians. And even myself included, I'm not sure in a Minnesota winter, am I going to walk a half mile out of my way to get to the nearest signalized crosswalk, or am I going to cross right where I am? And worse than that, if I get down to the crosswalk and no one stops for me, what was the point? So there are a lot of things that really influence pedestrian behavior that we really need to think more about. What are the systemic issues that are driving pedestrians to behave the way that they do? You know, no one wants to be struck by a motor vehicle, but we all make these decisions in the moment that are influenced by lots of things.
Let me get to James from Quakertown to join us. He's a school bus driver. And James, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Hello. Thank you for this issue.
Absolutely.
I drive school bus. And you would not believe when I drop a student off the bus, my red flashing lights, how many cars go flying by me.
I'm sitting here on the radio, James, shaking my head because obviously that's a huge safety issue. And do you still have those little flaps and things that come out on a school bus?
Absolutely, yes. And I always say, how can you miss me? I'm big, I'm yellow, and I have flashing lights. What don't you see?
That's such a good question. And you've got children on board. Well, let me toss that to Jake Nelson. And James, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Such an important perspective.
Yeah, so James raises a really interesting and egregious highway safety problem.
Absolutely.
That we've, you know, observed over the decades. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen become more common is, school buses armed with video cameras to record these motorists who overtake stop school buses. It's really hard to enforce the laws around stopping for a stop school bus with its, you know, lights flashing and its swing arm out. But, arming these buses with cameras is making it easier to get the license plate of these motorists who break the law and sort of create this understanding among the motorist population where this technology is available in that school district that if they do it, they will be caught and they will be ticketed and prosecuted potentially.
Absolutely. Nicole, what about regional differences? I'm thinking, you know, East Coast, West Coast, North, South. We talked a little bit about sort of rural, urban. Are we talking about different ways that people drive or navigate our roadways?
Well, certainly driving culture is very local. So you're going to have different types of experiences from town to town, city to city. And really, it is a language that drivers sort of speak to one another and how they travel. Certainly, the regional components are often driven by seasonal types of issues. So, you know, we tend to think of bad weather as being really dangerous for driving, but often it's the sunny, warm day where we have the greatest risk of fatal crashes because drivers do feel safer to go faster, or we have more drivers on the roadway all engaged in that type of behavior. So our sunniest states are going to have some of the greatest number of crashes. You have lots of year-round driving for motorcycles to be out where, and more cold weather states like where I'm at in Minnesota, you have fewer months of the year that you can be driving at those speeds or be on a motorcycle. So those are some of the things that really drive some of the regional differences that we see. But there are also a number of laws that really do drive some of these differences. So does your state have a primary seatbelt law? And what is the culture that we have within a state of the importance of wearing seatbelts? Because in many states, half of their fatal crashes are unbelted people in vehicles. And certainly wearing a seatbelt doesn't cause you to be in a crash, but it has a huge impact on the likelihood that you're going to survive that crash. And these are entirely preventable deaths. And we don't have every state agreeing that this is a real priority to make it a law that you must wear your seatbelt in every seat of the vehicle.
I did not realize that, Nicole. So there are states where it's not mandatory to buckle up?
Right. So states like Missouri do not have a primary seatbelt law. So you may get that as a secondary ticket for another driving infraction. But in states like Minnesota, where I am, you can be pulled over and ticketed primarily for that only infraction. So it really just speaks to the importance that the state has on that type of a behavior. And we see differences between the two states in how many belted versus unbelted fatalities that we have on our roadway. So it really does matter.
Let me toss this to Jake, and then we'll get Michael to join our conversation. Here in Philadelphia, one of our more dangerous roads is Roosevelt Boulevard or Route 1. So this is essentially a highway in the middle of a residential and sort of shopping area. It has traffic lights, you know, and crosswalks and median strips. And it is such a dangerous place for pedestrians. I don't think cyclists go on there. Hopefully they don't. But also for cars as well. That seems like a recipe for problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, roadway design, it can have a huge impact on sort of the safety experience of any road user operating in that environment, whether they're walking, biking, in a motor vehicle, whatever. And, you know, one of the challenges that we've seen at AAA about making infrastructure safer is that usually infrastructure upgrades aren't done installing safer environments for all road users in mind until that section of roadway expires and needs to be rehabbed. And then maybe, if you're lucky, these kinds of infrastructure treatments that sort of separate pedestrians and bicyclists from motor vehicle traffic and, you know, keeping the most vulnerable road users in mind and their safety top of mind, those kinds of treatments might be installed at that time. So I think that there's great promise to where we can get through the way we design roads, but I think it's going to take us a while to get there.
And a lot of money, I assume.
Yes, absolutely.
Let me get Michael from, looks like Westchester Technology, to join our conversation. And Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Just a couple comments on technology. I know many people who misunderstand what anti-lock brakes do for you. They don't shorten your stopping distance. They just enable you to steer. Many people who think that four-wheel drive allows you to drive on ice and snow, it just allows you to get moving. And one final comment, if I may, on driverless technology. I'm an airline pilot. Autopilots have been in airplanes for like 70 years. And one of the most common phrases still heard in airplanes is, what's it doing now?
Meaning that you're, now I have something else to worry about. But Michael, you're saying that even as a pilot, and the plane is essentially flying itself, obviously, you need to be paying attention, and you need to know what's going on.
That's exactly what I'm saying. We sit up there, and we watch it like a hawk.
And you watch it. Well, that's such an important point. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, Nicole, do you want to respond? I think this is something we were talking about earlier, which is we don't really understand how our cars work, how all the features
right.
work. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so when we think about how automation works, it's really like introducing a team member that doesn't speak the same language as you, doesn't follow the same culture, and really marches to the beat of its own drum. And because we're not speaking the same language, it's really hard to know what is that team member doing. And we start to make assumptions that may not be correct. So we often have things like we call automation surprises. So we misunderstand the state, or you know, we see this in aviation where, you know, a pilot is used to disabling the go-around function on this type of Boeing plane, and they get into another one, and you can't disable the go-around function in the same way. And that can have really catastrophic types of outcomes. So when we think about more and more automation getting into the vehicle, there are a number of instances where you would have known failures. And so, you know, if you think about many vehicles on the roadway, if you look to the manual, there may be 28 instances where the automated emergency braking system will unexpectedly engage. And does the driver of that vehicle, are they aware of all of those 28 instances when they should expect that their automated emergency braking system to engage unexpectedly? So it's a real problem. And, you know, ultimately, automation is not as smart as we think it is, and it really shifts the errors to different ways. So there's this great quote by Parasuraman that says, to the extent a system is made vulnerable to operator error, it is made more vulnerable to designer error, and given that the designer is also a human, this simply displaces the locus of human error. In the end, automation is really human after all. And so what this means is we still have people making decisions about how our automated systems are going to work. And so what's the amount of false alarms that we're going to accept in the system? And if you don't want very many false alarms, then that means that there's opportunity for misses, that automation is going to miss a pedestrian, like we saw with the Uber crash in Arizona. So there's a lot of things that are coming, right, and we're not really all ready for what this automation is going to do and how it's going to change our driving. It may make it safer. It may make it more dangerous because of all of these interactions.
Let me squeeze one more caller in. This is Matt calling us. And Matt, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. Let's hear what you have to say.
I just wanted to ask really quickly about, you talked about testing and doing retesting and stuff, but we really haven't looked at another cause, which is just the change in culture and the change in common courtesy that we see in driving that has changed over the years, I think. And I would like to hear comments on that.
I appreciate the call. Jake, can you take that?
Yeah,
are we just ruder in all our interactions in the world?
Well, I was just having this conversation with some friends of mine this morning at the gym, and I said to them that, you know, people will do things behind the wheel of their car, in their vehicle with the windows up on roads, that they would never dream of doing in line at a grocery store. Mm-hmm. Just the way we treat one another, what we're willing to accept, the kinds of things that we're willing to engage in. And I think this has been true for a long time, but I think the pandemic probably exacerbated it. Just stress, anxiety, all the things that we've already covered. But I think that's a real problem. And, you know, you've heard Nicole earlier mention this notion of culture. And I think when she was speaking, she was referring to it in the context of, like, regional differences and sort of the safety experience. But I think it's true in general, is the safety culture in our country, what we're willing to accept, how we treat one another, and our mindfulness behind the wheel. And just realizing that if somebody is riding your bumper and you're already going 10 miles over the speed limit, just move over and let them go.
Yeah.
Because in the long run, that's going to be better for everyone involved.
Well, that's the perfect place to end our conversation. Jake Nelson, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Thanks, Jake. And he's you're welcome. He's Director of Traffic Safety Advocacy and Research for AAA. Nicole Morris, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. She's director of the Human First Laboratory, research scholar at the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. And this week, Susan Greenbaum back driving things. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.